All right. I think it's probably a good time to make a couple of opening comments and then to get started. Actually, the only opening comment I have is to remind you about these index cards. There's a whole stack of them in the front, and strongly encourage you to write questions. At the moment, I have only one for this afternoon, so we may have a short session. In a serious way, please do ask questions a lot and write them down in advance if you wish to. So we are ready to do the second half of this morning's session, and John Rubenstein, who's in Toronto, will be talking about optimizing the acquisition. So it'll be more focused in on a more specific topic than what. John, go ahead.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be here. My objective for this lecture is to tell you how you might consider optimizing your image acquisition with the phrase used was a lower-end electron microscope, although at $1 million a pop, they're not exactly low-end instruments usually. And my hope is that I might even be able to affect the way that you acquire images. One of the frustrating things if you're trying to do biology by electron microscopy is there really is no consensus on how you should acquire images. So that's frustrating when you just want to get the biology. If you enjoy thinking about the physics, it can actually be something that's a lot of fun. So I'd like to ask you to consider this as a conversation. I'm going to be giving some advice, and if you disagree with my advice, then make a comment to that effect. We'll discuss it. And if we can't come to some consensus, we'll do what we usually do in this field, and we'll ask Bob and Richard what the real right thing to do is. So we know that even a 200 kV microscope is readily able to obtain atomic resolution data. So if you take a graphitized carbon grid, put it in your electron microscope, and you can fairly easily see the approximately 3.4 angstrom graphite layers in all directions. But we also know that our best 3D maps are not, and specifically for my group, our best 3D maps are not at atomic resolution. Furthermore, different maps from our group done on the same microscope with similar user level of expertise come out to very different resolutions. So these are three maps, all from this year. In the beginning of the year, we had this map from a bacterial V or A type HPAs where you could readily see some of the alpha helices in the membrane region of this complex. Just a few months later, we published this map of the bovine mitochondrial ATP synthase at significantly lower resolution. And then just out online yesterday, in fact, we have this map of the eukaryotic V-type ATPase at slightly worse resolution than our bacterial V-ATPase map, where you can start to resolve, if you really squint your eyes, a couple of things that might correspond to alpha helices. And these maps were all acquired by expert users using precisely the same microscope. And they all tried just as hard as each other to acquire these maps. So the question that we have is, why are these maps at different resolution? We think that we know why. If you look at how...
Could you switch the light off?
Oh, sure.
It's a second from the top.
Second from the top. How's that? So if these maps are different resolutions, are these images all good? And what is a good image? Let's try to answer that question. If we use a tilt pair test to determine the accuracy of alignment of our particle images, and this is something that Richard might talk about a little more, and Nico, of course, has mentioned this already, we can look at how accurately we're able to align these pairs of images. If we take random orientations for particle images, our little tilt pair test gives us a distribution of errors for those alignments that looks like this. For our 10 angstrom resolution map, you can see that we're aligning many of the images, but we're not aligning them particularly accurately, and we're misaligning quite a large fraction. And then for this complex, we're misaligning a huge fraction of the images. So we think the reason why we're not getting the same resolutions for the different complexes relates to the fact that we're able to align some molecules and not align other molecules, which is a little confusing because these are molecules of the same molecular weight.
What are the errors on the bottom?
I'm sorry, yeah, that's quite small. So this is pairs that had a 0 to 5 degree error in their alignment, up to pairs that had a 175 to 180 degree error in their alignment. So we're completely misaligning some images, and for this particle, we're misaligning most of the images. And I wouldn't be surprised if you did the sort of analysis with your own particles, you'll find that you actually don't align your particles as accurately as you think. So we're using the same electron...
How can you align something that has 80 degrees?
So this is the overall rotation. It's actually quite easy to do. So over Euler space, the big, if you think of the axis angle way of representing rotations, the biggest mistake you can make is having it 180 degrees wrong. So it turns out they're actually, so if you just take random orientations, this is the same a parameter file and another completely unrelated parameter file, you do find that it's 180, and that is the biggest error you can make. Why that's the most common, I'd have to think about that for a moment.
And why but do you make more 180s than you do?
That's exactly the other end, right? That's exactly Henning's question. Well, so this, okay, so that makes perfect sense. So this is, you pretended you have applied a 30-degree rotation, and then you checked how many particles are exactly where I thought they should be, that pretend 30-degree rotation, and almost none of them are. Whereas how many things are as far away from where you thought should be, are they, and quite a few things are. So this is something that's a little bit hard to picture, but it's something we deal with all the time. So this is a representative sample. It's a small fraction of tilt pair images. I think there are about 200 for this molecule and about 50 for this molecule. We don't collect all our images as tilt pairs. Okay, so that tells us that different molecules acquired on the same electron microscope, there might be different types, there might be different images that are considered good or bad images. So when we answer the question, what is a good image, if we're going to try to optimize an image, I would say that a good image contains high-resolution information that we're going to be able to extract by averaging images, but it also contains enough low-resolution information so that you can align your particle images. And in order to meet these criteria, we have some conflicting demands in the electron microscope. To get the high-resolution information, we want to reduce the drift in an image so that we don't smear out high-resolution features. We, of course, need coherent illumination, and we want parallel and untilted illumination. We want to use little defocus, and we want to use a low electron exposure to optimize our chances of getting the high-resolution information. However, to get enough low-resolution information, we want to use more defocus to emphasize the low-resolution features in the molecule, and we want to use higher electron exposures. So when we try to decide what is an optimal electron microscope image, we have to decide what are we trying to do with that image, and we're going to have to compromise and make choices, or perhaps with new detectors, we might not have to compromise, and we might be able to do better. In order to address these topics, we'll go through the electron microscope much as you do in alignment, starting at the top of the microscope and work our way down. We'll talk about coherence and beam tilt or coma. We'll talk about specimen drift, and we'll drop down a little bit further and talk about lens hysteresis, which might give image drift in the microscope. We'll talk about choosing defocus to optimize your images, radiation damage, and how we choose an electron exposure. And in order to address these topics, we're going to start talking about the gun, the condenser lenses, up here above the specimen, which we use to set up the illumination on your specimen. We'll talk about the specimen stage and the projector lenses. We'll talk about what's going on in the specimen itself. And we'll talk about the setting of the objective lens. So let's start with coherence and coma. In order to talk about this topic, we need to introduce some terminology. And the first two terms I want to introduce are temporal coherence and spatial coherence. We'll also talk about on-axis coma and off-axis coma. And the choices that we have to make when we're setting up our microscope to optimize images are what are the settings of the condenser 1 lens and condenser 2 lens that we use for illuminating the specimen, what's the setting of the condenser 3 lens if we have a continuously adjustable condenser 3 lens, what choice of condenser 2 aperture do we want to use, and how much of the specimen area do we want to irradiate. Let's start by defining these terms. Ideally, every electron that comes out of the gun in the electron microscope would have the same energy. If you accelerate one electron with a 1 volt potential, it acquires a kinetic energy of 1 electron volt. The 200,000 volt electron microscope, ideally every electron leaving the gun would have 200,000 EV of energy. So you look at a histogram of the distributions of energy, and you see there are no energies except for the energy that you applied by accelerating electrons with the gun. In practice, of course, you don't get a perfect electron source, and you have a spread of energies leaving the gun. The reason why we have the spread of energies is that the electrons in the gun had some kinetic energy before you accelerated them. So if we look at a hot tip, if we have an electron source and we heat it up, the kinetic energy distribution of the electrons in the tip will be quite broad. They'll each be moving in a random direction with a fairly large magnitude of motion. If we compare that to a cold electron tip, the magnitudes of those distributions of energies will be much smaller. So we take the kinetic energy of the electron in the tip, we accelerate it with 200,000 volts to give it 200,000 electron volts in that direction, plus whatever its kinetic energy was before you accelerated it. So if we look at the distribution of energies in that coming off that tip, we'll have this distribution that's proportional to the temperature. We'll have a Boltzmann distribution. So we know that in order to optimize the temporal coherence of the gun, we want to use as cold a tip as possible. It turns out that in the electron microscope, the temporal coherence is actually less important. The envelope from the temporal coherence is less stringent than the envelope from the other kind of coherence we're going to talk about. So that other kind of coherence is spatial coherence. Ideally, our electron gun is infinitely small, so that each electron leaves exactly the same point in space and is instant on the specimen, having traveled exactly the same distance. However, in practice, our electron source will have some finite width. So if you consider an electron instant on the specimen from the center of the gun, it'll have traveled this distance, L, whereas an electron leaving the edge of the gun, you can work out with Pythagoras' theorem, has traveled a slightly longer distance. So these two electrons, having traveled different distances to reach the same point in the specimen, are now out of phase with each other. And that imperfection, that finite size to the gun, gives us the spatial coherence envelope on information. So the conclusion we can draw from this sort of analysis is we want the gun to be as small as possible, or as distant as possible, to make it as spatially coherent as possible. The choices we make to affect the spatial coherence in the microscope are the size of the tip of the gun, and you make that choice when you buy the electron microscope, or when you equip it with a lab 6 filament versus a tungsten filament if it's a thermionic emission gun. We also set the brightness or set the size of the source with our gun lens, and the general rule is the higher the brightness, the less coherent, less spatially coherent that source will be. We also set the brightness and hence the coherence with the condenser 1 lens, the first condenser in the column. And again, the brighter it is, the less coherent it will be. The more dim it is, the more coherent it will be. And then we also set that brightness and coherence with the condenser 2 aperture. If you insert a small condenser 2 aperture, that'll be more spatially coherent than if you insert a large condenser 2 aperture. So it sounds like there are a lot of choices to make, but it actually simplifies quite a bit when you realize that there's this general trend. The brighter it is, the less coherent it is. So in order to make the gun as coherent as possible, you want to make the gun as least bright as you can afford. And the natural assumption then is you might want to set the gun to be as dim as you can possibly make it and yet still illuminate the area you want and have the dose rate you want. And that would be true if it were not for one thing. So this is the natural assumption, but it might not be the right thing to do, and that is because of coma. For my discussion of coma, I'll rely very heavily on Bob Glaser's paper from 2011. And first, let's define coma. Like, contrary to what you might think, coma is not the condition induced in most biologists upon reading a paper with the title Precise Beam Tilt Alignment and Correlation are Required to Minimize a Phase Error. It actually has to do with, in a sort of simplified way, electrons being instant on the specimen, not perpendicular, not normal to the plane of the grid. So there are two types of coma we have to worry about primarily. There's a third type that we won't discuss that has to do with the electrons spiraling through the optical axis of the microscope as you take the picture. That's actually quite a small source of coma, so we don't have to worry about it in most of our discussions. The first type of coma is this on-axis coma, and that has to do with the gun being tilted backwards and forwards. So you can have parallel illumination, but if the electrons are not perpendicular to the plane of the grid, then you'll have this phase error from that kind of coma. And the second kind of coma is this off-axis coma, or divergent and convergent illumination, where because the electrons are spreading apart as they leave the second condenser aperture, you have them hitting the specimen at different angles. Dealing with the first kind of coma requires that you use the coma-free alignment in your electron microscope. And most electron microscopes, I'm only familiar with the FEI microscopes. I haven't actually used the Joule microscope myself, but I presume it has precisely the same sort of coma-free alignment built in. What you do with the coma-free alignment is you apply a beam tilt backwards and forwards by a fixed amount in one direction and then a fixed amount in the other direction. And if your illumination without that beam tilt wasn't perfectly perpendicular to the plane of the grid, you'll have a bigger angle here and a smaller angle here. And when you look at the computed power spectrum, so you do need access to a CCD that gives you a real lifetime FFT, when you look at these two power spectra, you see that with the different amounts of beam tilt applied by the microscope, you have asymmetry in these power spectra. So this one looks like it has a different defocus and astigmatism than this one. So you would rock the beam back and forth until These two spectra look the same, and then you rock the beam back and forth in the perpendicular direction until these two spectra look the same. Until when you finish your coma-free alignment, the spectra look identical with the different amounts of rocking. And then in the center, you can assume that the beam is actually perpendicular to the plane of the specimen. Setting the off-axis coma, or making sure you don't have divergent or convergent illumination, is slightly more complicated. If you happen to have a third condenser lens, or a continuously adjustable third condenser lens, and this is a feature found on the Titan, all of FEI's Titan microscopes, it's found on the Zeiss Libre microscope. I asked Joel, and I was told that they have it on their Joel microscope, but I understand that, so Y is nodding, that you can continuously adjust the third condenser lens on the Joel microscopes. So I wasn't sure of that. So apparently on the Joel microscopes, you can also do that. So if you do have this third condenser lens, this alignment will probably be built into the automatic alignments that you do every time you set up the microscope. From my reading, I understand that you wobble the strength of the objective lens and make sure the size of the illumination doesn't change. And if you do that, you'll have non-convergent, non-divergent illumination. It'll be parallel illumination. If you don't have a third condenser lens, then what you need to do is appropriately choose the size of your second condenser aperture, your C2 aperture, and the area that you illuminate. So this is why you may not want to just set the brightness of your gun to be just bright enough to illuminate the area you want. You might need to choose an illumination area and a condenser 2 aperture size that give you parallel illumination. I'll tell you more about that in a second. The angle of this divergent illumination, I'm taking this directly out of, I think it's equation 5 from Bob's paper, you can calculate the angle of that divergent illumination with this expression. So what are the constants over here? There's the diameter of your C2 aperture. Are you using a 50 micron aperture? Are you using a 25 micron aperture? And then there's a constant that's microscope specific. And I've called FEI and got all the constants for their different microscopes in both the microprobe mode and the nanoprobe mode. So there's this demagnification of the C2 aperture from the front focal front focal plane of the objective lens of the microscope onto the specimen. So that's a constant that's microscope dependent. And then there's this variable, which is the area that you illuminate with the electron microscope. So let's make up a toy problem. Let's say that we're using an FEI F20 microscope in microprobe mode. So this MC2 constant is 5.2. If you insert a 5.2 micron condenser 2 aperture, so you've got 5.2 over 5.2, you would need to illuminate a 1 micron area of your specimen to have truly parallel illumination. We also have this constant over here, which is the distance from the specimen to the virtual image of the C2 aperture. That's also going to be microscope specific. So if you want truly parallel illumination with your 5.2 micron aperture, with your F20 microscope in microprobe mode, you'd have to illuminate 1 micron. These numbers actually start to sound slightly scary when you think about what size aperture do you usually use. So let's say you're using a 50 micron condenser 2 aperture, and you're in microprobe mode on your F20. That means you need to illuminate nearly 9 microns of your specimen area to get parallel illumination. So you really do need to think about this, and this might get you worried, but you should also think about where are you in the resolution of your map. So if you look at a 50 micron condenser aperture on an F20, then you'll basically have sufficiently parallel illumination to get to about 5.5 angstroms resolution. And if you have the same 50 micron aperture on F30, you should be able to get to about 4.5 angstroms resolution, regardless of the area that you illuminate, as long as it's around 1 or 2 microns. So you can actually draw different types of suggestions from these numbers. Bob will tell you that the right thing to do is to put the microscope in nanoprobe mode. You get a much bigger demagnification constant. That means you can use a large condenser aperture and illuminate a fairly small area of your specimen. And that is absolutely true. The reason why you might not want to do it is you have to be then very careful with the area of the specimen you illuminate. If you are wrong in the way you set that, the beam angle becomes much more sensitive to any error. Richard will probably tell you that if you can use a microscope with a microprobe mode, but then you have to use a fairly small condenser aperture, and you do have to spread the beam a little bit more than you might think you want to, but that should give you sufficiently parallel illumination. And I think both approaches should work. The take-home message here is you need to think about the problem. You need to make sure that you are using illumination that's consistent with the way you have your microscope set up and is consistent with your objectives for acquiring images. So the advice that I have for setting up coherent illumination and parallel illumination is use the brightest electron source that you can afford. if you have a thermionic emission microscope, you're best off using a Lab 6 source, but a field emission gun is better. And if you can afford one of FEI's new XFEGs, you will get a better spatial coherence envelope by going to a brighter source, demagnifying it more, and getting more coherent illumination. You should use a combination of condenser one aperture and condenser one lens setting, so your intensity setting, sorry, your spot size setting, and your condenser two aperture that gives you the brightness you need. But when you think about what the brightness you need is, also consider that you should be setting up your illumination to be sufficiently parallel for the resolutions that you want to obtain. And the easiest way to do that is, of course, to have a continuously adjustable third condenser lens like you have on the Titan microscopes or the Joule microscopes. So now let's talk about drift. And it's not surprising that as something moves, you will lose the high resolution features, but you'll still be able to obtain the low resolution features. So when I started preparing this lecture, I started to think about how much drift is actually allowable. And I did a little bit of a Microsoft Excel experiment where I plotted a sine wave. And the idea I want to get at here is, imagine that this sine wave represents the feature that you're trying to observe. And this sine wave has some wavelength lambda. Let's pretend it's 1 angstrom. So we want to know how much can this sine wave drift during an exposure and still allow you to resolve that 1 angstrom feature. Of course, 1 angstrom is not realistic for most of our objectives, but just to keep the numbers nice and simple. So the next thing I did was take 100 copies of this sine wave and spread them out over the drift distance that we're going to allow. So if we have no drift and each one of those 100 sine waves is perfectly overlapped and we add them together, then you get exactly the same sine wave. It's just 100 times bigger. If we allow a little bit of drift, let's say 1/32nd of the wavelength, then we have to worry about adding sine waves that are now no longer in phase. So several things we should realize are that whenever you add sine waves with the same wavelength, you can produce another sine wave of the same wavelength. But if those sine waves are offset, you're going to see the amplitude of the sine wave change and then the position of the maximum of that sine wave change. So as we add up these 100 sine waves that have been steadily shifted as we go through 1/32nd of the wavelength, we'll see that the resulting sine wave looks pretty similar. It's got almost the same amplitude and a very slight difference in the position of that maximum. So let's just keep increasing the amount of drift and adding up those sine waves. So here we've got 1/8 of the wavelength, so 1/8 of an angstrom. Here we've got 1/4 of the wavelength, 1/4 of an angstrom. Here we've got 1/2 of the wavelength. And we can see, by the time we get to 1/2 a wavelength, there still is 1 angstrom feature there. Its amplitude is significantly depressed, and its position is pretty far shifted, if you look at this one, from the position in the original sine wave. So let's keep on going. Here we're now 2/3 of the wavelength, and the feature is still there. That's depressed. And it's only when we get up to the full wavelength and add up all those sine waves that feature disappears entirely. So this is the sort of analysis we have to consider when we talk about what's going to happen to the features you're trying to observe if your specimen or image are drifting as you acquire the image. And the reason why these features might move could have to do with your cryoholder. If your cryoholder is not at a constant temperature, that barrel is actually expanding and contracting due to a change in temperature, your image, your specimen is going to move. If you have boiling in the dewar of the cryoholder, that's going to cause a vibration, and that could cause the drifting, the blurring of features. If your grid isn't secured properly in the, this is kind of an out-of-date Gitan clip ring system, but if the grid isn't well secured, then your grid could also move. So a trick that John Berryman taught me quite a few years ago was what you should be able to do after you clamp a grid in is take a pair of forceps and poke it through the grid. This is not a grid you're trying to take images from. Poke it through the grid and then try to move the grid with the forceps. If your grid is really well secured by the cryoholder, the grid won't move. The grid bars will actually tear. So that's something you should try if you're on a sacrificial grid. You all have old negative stain grids lying around. Take your cryoholder, clamp it in, and see if you can move that grid around. And if you can move that grid around, that might be a source of drift. Surprisingly, I've worked with cryoholders where you can move the grid around, but the grid still seems stable in the electron microscope. And you could also have an unstable microscope stage. You could have an unstable holder, Or you could have some unstable, and this is not something I truly understand, but an unstable combination of holder and stage. Are there other sources of image movement? And yes, there are possible sources. And here's one where I've never used the microscope in this mode, so I've never seen this problem, but I wonder whether people have actually observed this problem in practice. And the problem comes from the fact that when we do low-dose microscopy, we have to keep changing the magnification of the electron microscope. So most of us will acquire magnifications at something like 50,000 times on film. And at 50,000 times magnification, these are the excitation levels of the different lenses of our microscope. So the condenser one lens is at spot size at 14.3% excitation. The intensity knob that controls condenser two knob, that condenser two lens, that's at about 51% excitation. And we have all of these different excitations for the microscope. And that would be nice and stable if we just left the microscope there. But when you go to different magnifications, you might drop the magnification of your microscope. And we want to go to a fairly low magnification to be able to find the right grid square, find the right hole. When you do that, let's look at what happens to the excitations of the different lenses. Primarily, well, the illumination should be pretty much the same if you haven't touched it. But the objective lens becomes less strong. And the projector one lens pretty much turns off. So that's a problem because the ideal lens doesn't behave by this ideal signal response curve. What we'd like to be able to do is turn off a lens and have the lens current go to zero. And pretty much when you cut the power to something, it will go to zero. But then turn it back on and have the lens go to full strength right away. And turn it off and on and all those things you're going to do during your EM session. But what we see in practice for real instruments is that when you turn something on, it's not going to come to full power right away. You're going to have this hysteresis. So if you're constantly turning lenses on and off and then taking pictures right after you turn the lens on, you might have that lens drifting in its power. And that's going to cause the focus to change. It could cause the magnification to change. And that's going to cause something very similar to specimen drift. So one thing you could do is buy a Titan Krios microscope where they have this constant power lens setup, or you could save yourself a few million dollars and just do what I think most of you are probably doing already. And rather than drop the magnification in search mode by just going to low magnification, put the microscope in a diffraction mode and then spread that central diffraction spot. So what you see in the middle of that diffraction spot is an image where all of the scattered electrons have been removed from the image. And when we do that, if we look at the excitation levels of different lenses, we can see the objective lens is still pretty much where it was before. And that first projector lens is not at the same value as it was in the high magnification mode, but it's at a sufficiently close value that we don't expect this huge amount of hysteresis as we go between this mode and this mode. So I'm not sure, is anybody using low-dose microscopy with a low magnification search mode and observing that their image changes as they switch to high magnification? Okay, so then this is a solution for that problem. So my suggestions for ensuring that you have a stable specimen and image is make sure that your cryo holder actually clamps your grids properly. There's a microscope that was in Toronto when I first arrived that I don't use for cryo-EM, and we never they never tested that cryo holder properly, and I was never able to get it to stop drifting. And when you duck your pair of forceps through a grid, you can see that it was never actually clamping that grid in properly. Ensure that your cryo holder is stable in the microscope before you collect data. Use a defocused diffraction pattern rather than a low magnification mode for your searching. And you could, and this is something I think Nico might talk about, you could use a direct detector for computationally fixing the drift that might occur. Well, one thing that's not there is a good investment is a graphitized carbon grid. So when we're testing out holders for a microscope, I spent tens of hours staring at graphitized carbon in movie mode and checking to see how much it's moving and if that amount of movement is consistent with what we're trying to use the microscope for. And if it's not, that's not a holder that you want to use. So now let's talk about defocus. And this is just a series of power spectra acquired on our microscope using a demo version of the DE12 camera. It's a little bit of astigmatism. It's slightly embarrassing. I didn't realize it was there when I started preparing the slides. And you can just see from this defocus series that as you defocus the microscope, the tone rings move closer to the center. So the information at low resolution near the center gets more and more complicated. And then the oscillations of the tone rings become closer together. And the spatial coherence of the microscope actually damps these tone rings at lower and lower resolution. Without worrying about the damping from coherence of the microscope, let's just look at what we expect the tone ring or the CTF pattern to be at different defocuses. We know that at high defocus, The first maximum of the contrast transfer function will be at low resolution. That's going to emphasize the low resolution features, and that's going to allow you to see your particles and align your particles. But at that high defocus, the oscillations in the CTF get closer and closer together, and also due to the spatial coherence of the microscope, that power spectrum will be damped at high resolution. In comparison, low defocus, that first maximum of the CTF is at higher resolution. You're not going to be able to see the low resolution features you want for aligning particle images and for even picking particle images, but the CTF is simpler at high resolution. So we have these conflicting requirements. We can use high defocus, where we'll have this high contrast, low resolution. It will allow us to pick particles and align them, but we're going to have a harder time with the coherence of the microscope, and we're going to have a harder time sorting out those oscillations of the CTF. So we could choose low defocus and have slower oscillations as an advantage, so we'll be able to have an easier time figuring out the CTF and extracting the high-resolution information, have a less severe coherence envelope, so the high-resolution information will be less damped. However, we might not be able to see the particles to pick them, and we might not be able to align them. So what is the perfect advice for this? I can't give you a perfect number. I'll just say use as much defocus as you need, but not more. So people in our lab will basically see how little defocus they can get to and still see the particles and still have the particles aligned precisely. So now let's talk about radiation damage. And I'll just talk about the effects of radiation damage. I won't actually talk about what's going on in the specimen during radiation damage. That's a very interesting topic. There's all sorts of interesting radiochemistry that goes on, and lots of things we can actually say by looking at what goes on in radiation damage and X-ray crystallography. But I'll just limit myself to talking about how it affects our imaging. And we know from many, many years of experiments that as you irradiate a specimen, you destroy the high-resolution information. This is just some computed power spectra from images of catalase crystals. And you can see that if you acquire an image with 8 electrons per angstrom squared and calculate its power spectrum, you can see these low IQ or high-quality spots right out to around 3 angstroms resolution without trying very hard. If you then take that crystal that you've already irradiated with 8 electrons per angstrom squared and take another picture with 8 electrons per angstrom squared, the low-resolution information is still pretty good, but that high-resolution information is now gone. And if we continue to irradiate that specimen, the information fades from the high-resolution towards the low-resolution until you get to around 100 electrons per angstrom squared, and there we just have a little bit of information left at the origin, and all that high-resolution information is now removed. In order to talk about radiation damage, we're going to have to define some more terms. We'll talk about cross-section of interaction. We'll talk about elastic versus inelastic interactions. Talk about exposure and dose. So these are terms that are often used interchangeably in the cryo-EM community, but there actually are precise meanings for both of these terms. And then we'll talk about the linear energy transfer. And the choices we're going to have to make with our electron microscope is what voltage we want to use the microscope at, and what electron exposure do we want to use. So let's talk about cross-section first. The cross-section is a way of expressing the probability of an electron actually interacting with a specimen. So if I were to offer David a couple of golf balls or ping pong balls, depending on how lucky I feel, and tell him to try to hit me with them, if I were standing facing him like this, presenting a large cross-section, he'd have a better chance of hitting me than if I presented a smaller cross-section. So a high cross-section, a high surface area cross-section, means you've got a high probability of that particle interacting with the specimen, whereas a low area cross-section means you've got a low probability. And this somewhat unusual unit, barn, comes from actually a group of physicists doing scattering experiments from uranium in the U.S. right around the Second World War, and they realized that the scattering cross-section of uranium was so high that it was basically the size of a barn. And they then realized, that's actually quite a large unit of area, and they came up with some other terms to indicate different units of cross-section. And these are actually units that were used for some time. One thing to realize is that electrons of different energies have different cross-sections of interaction. So a low-energy electron will have a higher cross-section of interaction with a carbon atom than a high-energy electron would have with that same carbon atom. And if we do get some sort of interaction, we can have different things happening. So let's do an experiment where we send an electron in to hit the specimen. We're going to send it in with some kinetic energy. We accelerate that electron with 200,000 volts, now has 200,000 electron volts of kinetic energy. And when it hits a specimen, one of two things can happen. Actually, other things can happen, but to a good approximation, one of two things can happen. It can leave the specimen with the same kinetic energy that it came in with. We call that an elastic scattering event. And No energy is deposited in the specimen, and that's exactly what we want the electron microscope to do, because these are the scattering events that are going to tell us something about our specimen. If these were the only things that happened in the electron microscope, we wouldn't be here, because electron microscopy would routinely provide atomic resolution structures of just about anything you want to look at. Unfortunately, what happens most of the time is the electron leaves a specimen with less energy than it came in with. We call that an inelastic scattering event, and that deposits energy in the specimen, and that is what causes radiation damage. That's what destroys your specimen. Now, other things can happen. There are types of elastic scattering events that we call knock-on damage, where an electron will actually knock an atom directly out of the specimen. It's an elastic interaction because no energy was deposited in the specimen. But to a good approximation, we don't have to worry about those for biology, because the cross-section of those sorts of events are actually so small that they don't affect these rates of radiation damage. So now that we know what can happen, we need to think about how we're going to irradiate the specimen. So the first term I want to define is the exposure. And the exposure is the number of electrons incident per square angstrom of the specimen. Ideally, we'd measure that with something like a Faraday cup, where we can measure the flux of electrons very precisely. But in practice, we can actually get a pretty good approximation by measuring the current of electrons incident on your phosphor screen. You put a current meter attached to your phosphor screen. It's probably built into your microscope. And that will tell you how many electrons you have passing or hitting the screen at any time. And you can use that to work out the exposure of electrons on your specimen. That's actually somewhat different than the term dose, which if you talk to radiation physicists, will tell you that's the amount of energy absorbed by the specimen. And that's denoted in units of electron volts per gram or joules per kilogram, which is the same as the gray. And that will, of course, be dependent on the number of electrons you apply to your specimen, but it will also be different for different electron energies. The way that you can convert between the exposure and dose is by using this quantity known as the linear energy transfer. So I've taken some linear energy transfers approximated for biological specimens out of Bob's book from 2007, and they have these very strange units of mega electron volts centimeter squared per gram, and these change with different electron energies. And just for those of you that worry about units, you can see that if you take an exposure and electrons per angstrom squared, multiply it by the linear energy transfer, you do end up with a quantity in terms of joules per kilogram. So you can convert between exposure and dose using this linear energy transfer. If we look at what the cross sections of electrons are versus electron energy, so this is from Richard's classic 1995 paper, we'll just zoom in on the electron energy versus the atomic cross section for both elastic and inelastic events. And of course, you can convert electron energy also into wavelength. So let's just focus on that section of the plot. First thing we notice is that the cross-section for inelastic events decreases with the wavelength or the energy of the electrons. And similarly, the cross-section for these informative elastic events decreases with the wavelength or energy of the electrons. But unfortunately, they maintain a constant ratio of about 3:1. So you cannot have fewer inelastic events per elastic event just by changing the voltage of the microscope. And similarly, the amount of energy deposited per inelastic event also remains constant at around 20 electron volts. So you cannot avoid this problem of radiation damage by changing the voltage of the microscope. If you go to a different energy, you'll have a different number of events occurring. But if you increase the exposure to get the same number of events occurring, you'll have the same ratio of inelastic to elastic events, and each inelastic event will deposit the same amount of energy. So you can't avoid the problem. But you do have to account for that when you set up your microscope experiment. You have to come up with what is the equivalent exposure of electrons that will cause the same number of scattering events. That can be a little bit tricky, so I've set up this handy equivalent exposure calculator. This is yours to keep. You can take it home and use it every time you set up an electron microscope experiment or every time you decide to go from one microscope to another microscope. I calculated these numbers based on the linear energy transfers, but you can equivalently calculate these numbers based on atomic cross sections of interaction. So we see that if we have let's say we want to do an experiment, and we know that the ideal exposure at 100 kV is 10 electrons per angstrom squared. If we then want to do an experiment at 300 kV, we need to multiply that 10 electrons per angstrom squared by 1.8 to get the same number of scattering events. If we know the exposure that we used at 300 kV and we want to get the same number of scattering events at 100 kV, we need to multiply by 0.56. Okay. So that tells us that we should be able to adjust the exposure in order to account for differences in the voltage, differences in scattering cross-section. Even if we do that, the images will look different, and that's because the defocuses. will be different, or the contrast transfer functions will be different for the same defocus. These are CTFs plotted for the same 3-micron defocus for a 100 kV microscope and 300 kV microscope. This is a point that Yifan raised on our first day, that you have to adjust both the defocus and the exposure to get similar images at different voltages. So in order to come up with equivalent exposures at different voltages, I've prepared another handy calculator. And this handy calculator simply keeps the product of the wavelength and the defocus constant. So you know that if you used a certain defocus at 100 kV, and then you want to go to 300 kV, you need to multiply that defocus by 1.88. And if you had a certain defocus at 300 kV and you want to go to 100 kV, you need to multiply that defocus by about 0.53. And when you do that, so here's that 3-micron defocus at 100 kV, and then here's the 3-micron defocus at 300 kV multiplied by that correction factor to give you 5.6 microns defocus. And you can see at low resolution, now those CTFs are pretty much the same. They're still different at high resolution. That's because the product of wavelength and spherical aberration are still different with these different microscopes. But in order to get equivalent images at different voltages, you have to adjust the exposure, and you also have to adjust the defocus, and you're not going to avoid this problem of radiation damage. There are other choices you have to make based on voltage. Radiation damage probably isn't one of them, but you should realize that the curvature of the Ewald sphere, this deviation from the approximation that our images are a projection of the specimen onto the 2D plane of the image, that Ewald sphere curvature is going to be more severe at low voltage, so high voltage should give you an advantage for Ewald sphere curvature. Beam tilt, if you have a certain amount of beam tilt, that'll be less severe at high voltage than it is at low voltage, and that's going to have a big effect at high resolution, so that's another reason why you might want to use a high voltage microscope. Because of those reduced scattering cross-sections, for a specimen of the same thickness, you'll have more multiple scattering events at low energy. So going to higher voltage will allow you to look at thicker specimens. Now, some detectors actually work better at high voltage, like direct detectors, but some detectors actually work significantly better at low voltage. So if you're using film or CCD, you actually get a significantly better DQE at low voltage. So all of these factors should be considered in your choice of voltage, and you should base that on your objectives in the experiment. So let's return to this idea of radiation damage. Now that we know how to take equivalent exposures with different microscopes at different voltages, let's figure out actually what's happening. Quite a while ago, in a paper by Richard Nigel, I didn't put the citation there, they realized that the fading of these diffraction spots followed an exponential function. And Bob Glaser with, I don't remember who Hayward was, worked out that the signal-to-noise ratio as a function of exposure goes up and then down. This is exactly what Nico talked about the first day. If you use no electrons to acquire your image, there's no signal-to-noise, there's no signal in the image, so you're over here in the curve. As you add in images, the signal-to-noise ratio accumulates until you've destroyed that feature in the image, and then you're just adding noise, so the signal-to-noise ratio starts to go down. So when we're working on these rotary HPAs, these small protein complexes in detergents where we have trouble figuring out the alignments, we realized we might want to optimize the signal-to-noise ratio at lower resolutions in order to be able to align our particle images. We thought we could just go and look up these constants. So although Richard and Bob and Holger, in his earliest days as a scientist, I think, calculated what these critical exposures were for high-resolution features, we found that you actually couldn't look them up for low-resolution features. So a graduate student in the lab and a summer student spent a summer taking lots of images of these catalase crystals so that we could work out both the critical exposure and the optimal exposure for spatial frequencies all across the spatial frequency range. So not just considering the high-resolution information, but also the low-resolution information that we might need to use in order to be able to align our particle images. So we worked out these critical exposure curves, and from Bob's paper, we realized that about 2.5 times of critical exposure is the optimal exposure to use. And from here, we could calculate curves like this, where we look at what is the signal-to-noise ratio at a given resolution as a fraction of the best it could be as a function of exposure. So if we look at low resolution information, like 80 angstroms, we see that we need to use a very large electron exposure to get up to the best signal-to-noise we can for that feature. But for high-resolution features, you have to use a very low electron exposure in order to optimize the signal-to-noise ratio. Another way of looking at this data is, for a given electron exposure, how well are you doing at different spatial frequencies? So with 10 electrons per angstrom squared, you're doing as well as you can do for the 3 angstrom resolution information, but you're really not getting all of the low-resolution information that you could. you're getting about 60% of the best you could do by using a higher exposure. If you used a really high electron exposure, like 75 electrons per angstrom squared, you're not doing well anywhere. But if you use, let's say, 20 or 30, then you're optimizing the signal-to-noise ratio at low resolution. That should allow you to align your particle images. But you're sacrificing signal-to-noise ratio at high resolution. So when you use a CCD or a piece of film, you have to compromise. You've got to decide, do I want to optimize at low resolution or do I want to optimize at high resolution? If you're working on something like a virus where aligning particles is actually quite easy, forget about the low resolution information. It's going to be good enough, and your high resolution information is what you want to optimize. If you're working on a small particle image, a small particle, you might actually consider using a higher electron exposure so that you can actually align those particle images. And this compromise is really unsatisfying because I can't tell you what electron exposure to use for your particle. You just have to say, oh, I think the low resolution is going to be important, or I think the low resolution is fine, I'm going to be able to align, so I want to emphasize the high resolution. Maybe we don't need to compromise. So one thing that we propose in this paper, sort of obvious idea if you have a direct detector, is why use one exposure for all spatial frequencies? Why not use this electron exposure for the high resolution information and this electron exposure for the low resolution information? All that you need to do that is to acquire a movie so that you combine the frames, so the high resolution information is encoded by the first few frames of the movie, and the low resolution information is encoded by the final, or the sum of all the frames of the movie. So my suggestions over here are use enough electron exposure to be able to determine your particle orientations, but not more, so you preserve the high resolution information as best you can, and if at all possible, use a direct detector combining frames of a movie in order to optimize all the spatial frequencies, and don't compromise on either low resolution or on high resolution. So to summarize, my main message is when you acquire an image, you need to think. You need to do this deliberately. You need to figure out what the objectives are, what your objectives are in the experiment, and then make your choices for how you take the image to optimize the chances of achieving those objectives. You should use a gun that gives you as good spatial coherence and temporal coherence as possible. Choose your electron exposure depending on the objectives of your experiment and consider which voltage you're using when you choose your electron exposure. Align your microscope in order to prevent this this on-axis coma. Use the coma-free alignment. And then if you don't have access to a third condenser lens, use a C2 aperture and an intensity or C2 setting that gives you sufficiently parallel illumination to avoid off-axis coma. Make sure before you even take pictures that your specimen is not drifting. Choose your defocus and consider your voltage again to optimize your chances of building your map properly, and avoid turning that projector lens on and off by using a defocus diffraction pattern. So I didn't talk about a lot of experimental data, but I did show you maps from two former graduate students, Wilson Lau's map at 9.7 angstroms of the Thermus thermophilus BHPs, and Lindsay Baker's map of the bovine HP synthase at around 18 angstroms resolution. We have Samir's recent map of the eukaryotic VHPAs at around 11 angstroms resolution. And then Stephanie Bueller has helped out with a lot of these projects. So I'd be happy to take any questions.